Education is a topic that we have addressed often on the Dr. Lisa Radio Hour and podcast. And the way that we offer education within the state of Maine is something that is of great interest. There are a lot of relationships between health and education and wellness, and it's something that we think is important. So today we have with us Glenn Cummings, Dr. Glenn Cummings, who is the president and the executive director of the Maine Academy of Natural Sciences. And we also have John Denary, head of school at the Harpswell Coastal Academy. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Susan Conley of Maine Magazine wrote an article about your schools and about chartering, charter schools here in Maine for Maine Magazine coming up in November. And she had some interesting thoughts and some very interesting experiences with the students at your schools. You are offering a very unique way to educate our children. Why did you become first interested in education? I guess I'll ask Glenn first, and you're Dr. Cummings because you have a PhD in education.
I have a doctorate in education, but it's really in higher education. So, I had started my career back when I was 22, and I came back to Maine from graduate school and taught social studies at Gorham High School. And, I thought I would just do it a couple of years, maybe go to law school in my late 20s or mid-20s, and it captured my imagination. It drained every piece of energy out of me in a good way, I think. And I think for me, it began like this Rubik's Cube of like, how do you get better? How do you move things in parts that actually make education better for more kids? And I could see where the programs that we had, certainly in those days at Gorham High School, were working, but I could also see where, boy, if we could just do it differently a little bit, we could bring in that other 30% that's really not engaged. You know, they may be doing their work, but they're not really fully engaged and not reaching their full potential. And so I guess that challenge kind of hooked me early.
And what about you, John?
Actually, a kind of different story. In high school myself, large suburban high school, was not feeling that it was relevant or very useful. Went to college, left college, worked off and on. It was 10 years before I actually finished my bachelor's degree and then worked some more. Ran a nonprofit arts collaborative in Kentucky for a while. And at 30, went back and got a Master of Arts in Teaching. So didn't start teaching until I was, had done a whole bunch of jobs, truck driving and pizza making and all kinds of things. Worked at Pat's Pizza in Orono for a very short time. And so I think for me, it really comes out of a sense that for many, many, many kids, especially those kids in poverty or rural kids. My mom grew up in rural Maine. That a lot about what schools were doing just weren't working for way too many kids, but have fierce, fierce commitment to the public school system. So not feeling like the solution to that was to sort of create a separate track of schools, but really to try to work in public schools to dramatically reinvent them.
What is it about Maine that is so unique, that has so many students really kind of needing to navigate things in a different way?
Well, I'm not sure Maine is that unique. I think when you look nationally, the statistics are even more startling and quite frankly, dismal when it comes to high school graduations. And so when you look at how many kids are voting with their feet in terms of leaving, especially large urban high schools, it's significant. In some places in Chicago and Philadelphia, you're talking about 50 or 60% between their freshman and their senior year never actually complete. So Maine's graduation rate is much higher. It's gone from about 80% up to about 82.5%. So we're seeing a little bit of progress in the last couple of years as we spend more time focusing on. Legislators have gotten, I think, over the last 10 years, much more focused about how to, monitor, I think, the success of avoiding dropout. So when you really look at how we're engaged, nationally, it's of great concern. But in Maine specifically, we definitely have large segments of rural poverty, and that seems to be correlated to dropout. And then we have increasing just poverty in general, even in areas that you might not expect it. So those things are definitely contributing. And then there's just the, it may not be related to poverty, it may be simply that the way in which we go about high school, for example, when we're a high school, there's a lot of, you know, I guess you'd call it sort of sit and get, you know, so you have to sit there for 5.5 hours and, you know, sort of digest information and kind of put it back out. There, the models that I think John and I are trying to play with is, how do you get real-world challenges, authentic kind of assessments, and how do you build units around those things that that would challenge students in an interesting way, but also add value to the community? So we're trying to think about new ways to get students to feel differently about what they're doing and why they're doing it.
I would just add one thing. It's not that makes Maine unique, but it is a particular challenge to do sustainable school reform in rural areas where the economics of a state with 1.2, 1.3 million people and the geography that we have are very, very different. So when you have a New York, or I've, you know, done some work in New York and Boston and urban areas where you really can create innovation within a large system. For instance, the small schools movement in New York has really produced some documentable excellent results for kids, but the economics of Maine don't lend themselves to easily reinventing what has increasingly become a larger school system towards small schools. So if relationships are what works for kids and relationships flourish in smaller schools, my career has been, you know, a lot of projects that are trying to demonstrate that small schools are sustainable over time, but need very, very different economic models, different teaching models in order to make them sustainable.
Each of you has looked at education sort of from an eagle's view. I know that, Glenn, you've been involved in politics. You were the Speaker of the House. You worked for the Obama administration. John, you're a member of the Kappa class of the Institute for Civic Leadership. So to each of you, it's much bigger than just what do we do within a school. It's how do we make inroads or connections? How do we understand education from a community perspective? Talk to me a little bit about that.
There's definitely, I mean, it, I remember being in the Legislative Education Committee early in my career, and the sort of the crossfire of politics is very complicated in Maine, particularly around high property value communities versus low property value communities and how much state aid. And where, you know, I represented Portland, which is neither one of those really. And so we had to, we were certainly often challenged politically to get our voice heard. You know, from our, my perspective, first of all, everybody believes deeply, you know, usually if you talk to people, you know, at a party or something about education, their eyes sort of glaze over. But if you get them to talk about their education and their experience and their commitment, people have very passionate views about it. And so the community, certainly from a personal perspective, people are often very clear about what they like and what they don't necessarily like about education. They have very definitive views, which certainly in our world of charter schools, you know, it's always interesting to hear what people have to say. We have tended to have kind of a nice blessing in terms of how people look at our school, the Maine Academy for Natural Sciences, because we try to go after kids who are really struggling. Not necessarily academically, but they may be struggling in a variety of ways with school, socially and emotionally, and feeling like they need a new experience and they want to engage in the curriculum in a different way. And so I think we tend to sort of stay out of some of that politics, which has not been the case for all the charter schools in Maine, have often run aground a little bit with that. But our perspective is let's focus on what's really good for the kids. And if we can prove that there's a challenge that the kids can't get met at that local public school or even other private school, then there's a place for us to give it a try.
I think I would add that we've evolved to a system of public schooling where there are certain ways in which the community or the parent community is involved in schools, and many ways in which they're not. And often they're not involved deeply in what I would call the actual work of students in schools. And our notion of community-based or place-based education really has those students out studying the clam flats, which are under threat in Harpswell, and preparing informed reports to testify before town committees and to interact with the shellfish warden and those kinds of things. And you know, our kids will be going out on a lobster boat this weekend. Casco Bay does a lot of those things too. But the idea that the work of the school is not just bringing parents in for boosters or for bake sales, but for letting the kids and the community members know that their work is shared work, and that if they're very separate, it's going to be very difficult for that gulf between what the students feel is relevant and what the community expects to ever be bridged. But once you put those people together, often very, very different people in terms of how they define their adult lives, but you put them in a learning situation with students, and some of those gaps diminish quite quickly for the benefit of both the adult and the kid.
That's a really interesting idea, and one that we've actually sort of bandied about on the show before, and that is that we've gotten to a place where, you know, adults get up in the morning and go off to their jobs, kids get up in the morning and go off to their schools, and sort of never the two shall meet. But what you're describing really is a collaborative. So the kids get an idea of, this is what could happen when I graduate from school. This is where I could, you know, be of value to the community. This is where I could be of value to the community even now. So I'm not sure exactly how we got to the place where each had its own silo, but I think it's really great that we're coming back to an understanding that really we're all connected, adults, kids, community, schools.
I would just add that that's one of the things that public charter law, there's a lot of understandings of what charter schools do, and they do very different things in very different states, and each individual charter. That I often say that, you know, the thing that holds charter schools together is only that they're named charters. They can be as different as any other school, but they are designed to be a 501c3 nonprofit, which has a nonprofit mission, combined with a government mission, which really does change the game somewhat. It allows you to work in a different way. In fact, forces you to work in a different way, because we're not really funded at the same level as traditional public schools in Maine. I'm fine with how we're funded. I think it ultimately works, but it creates a challenge where we're always going to have our community support us in a way that is not in any way a luxury. It absolutely has to be part of our business model, which means the community has to feel that a public charter school is a crucial part of that community's life.
And that's something that Goodwill Hinckley and the Maine Academy of Natural Sciences is working on even right now. You have a capital campaign that's launching in order to bring back funds to, sustain your school.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so a typical public school would put out to a bond vote whether they were going to increase or redo a new school. There's nothing in the law that says that charter schools get that luxury, so we don't get to apply for state construction money or anything like that. So what we have a growing waiting list of over 30 students right now who can't get into the school. And we're in a sort of a temporary place on campus. We really need a permanent home. So, yeah, we've begun that hard process of raising money, and fortunately people are stepping up, and we're beginning to see some interest there as we begin this month. But it's going to be a long road, and it does put a pressure on charter schools that probably, there are lots of pressures on public schools, don't get me wrong, but there's a pressure on charter schools here where if you want to do these extra things, you're going to have to raise money. And we just received a federal grant, for example, that will help us with professional development. For a lot of schools, they'd say, well, that sort of should be built in your budget. Well, we don't really have that luxury of really deep investment. We don't know where that extra money would really come from for our teachers. So we had to apply for outside resources to make that happen. I also wanted to go back to what John had said earlier about the importance of relationships and in schools. You know, when we think about it, what is it that we're doing differently with kids is that we're taking pretty seriously that there's a Phi Beta Kappa magazine that comes out, does an annual survey of adults, parents, every 3 years. And every year when they say, well, what do you want from schools in this country? Like, what do you want most for your child? And they all say the first thing, which you would expect it to be, well, I want them to learn a lot, and I want them to get into great school. And actually, that's not the first thing. They always say, I want somebody in that school who knows my child and likes my child. And for any large suburban high school or any large-sized high school, which I think was why John talked so strongly about the importance of small schools, is that somebody, the commitment that we're making at the Maine Academy of Natural Sciences, somebody will know your child and like your child, and we'll all like your child. Somebody will really know them well. And I think that changes the dynamic for that kid. So even when they're having a bad day, we understand the long term, we understand where they're coming from, and we know that eventually that will make a big difference in whether they stay persistent in their degree, that somebody is not going to let them just disappear. So it has turned out to be sort of the fundamentals. Now on the larger scale, building those relationships with the local communities, and it's much more challenging work, but certainly with the parents and with the kids, it seems to be a major difference from the experience that the kids had in their previous schools, where they didn't always feel that they had that adult advocate.
And I want to just also say that Harpswell Coastal Academy is doing its own form of fundraising, and I know that you're going into even a workshop today as we're talking, trying to understand how best to work on the development of your financial support, I guess. I mean, that is an interesting thing for teachers and administrators to have to think about it in a really different way.
Well, we have, so Glenn talked about it too. So in a traditional public school, you're not going out, you're buying buses, but you're not starting a bus fleet from scratch, and you have a building. Well, we have a building that was a school that was built, eventually expanded to serve maybe 110, 120 elementary school kids. We're designed to be a school of 240 to 280 students, which is, I think, the smallest we can be and make the sustainable small school economics work over time, which means we're going to need a building. So on the one hand, we're keeping a vital community building that was probably going to be underused or possibly not used at all. We're keeping that in the community. We're able to sort of reuse that building. But we are going to need from scratch, you know, significant facilities over time. And that kind of, it does, again, motivate that community to say, so what do we need to do? On the other thing that I think is worth noting is that Harpswell, which has the, at least at one point, had the widest economic disparity in income in the state of Maine, the difference between the poorest people in Harpswell and the wealthiest people was the largest on average. And, It's a community that is, you know, our school is 14 miles down a peninsula. And those kids have been, if you're in middle or high school, have been driving up the peninsula through Brunswick to Mount Ararat High School for years. And as that education asset leaves the community, it becomes very difficult to draw families who can see themselves living in that community over time, if that's the bargain they have to make to do so, is we're going to put our kids on a bus for an hour in each direction. We're able to eventually bring $2.4, $2.5, maybe $3 million of economic activity to a very small town. And that's something that has been leaving. If you go up to Washington County or you go up to other parts of Maine, when Lubeck lost its school, they fought, you know that story somewhat, Glenn, is they fought and fought and fought to keep that school because the economics of keeping that school were bigger than just the dollar per student economics of the actual educational endeavor. That's another thing that I think is really important, that these investing in schools in many communities in Maine, if you look at not just the efficiency, Tom Shepard, who's been on the show, talks about that, not just efficiency, but productivity. If you invest in productivity, sometimes you want to make some calculations that aren't just about short-term efficiency.
Each of you also has links to Casco Bay High School, which we've featured on the show before. We had Derek Pierce, who's the principal of Casco Bay High School, and I believe that they're 10 years in now from doing the type of expeditionary learning that they've been promoting. John, you have teaching experience there, I believe.
No, I worked for expeditionary learning.
You worked for expeditionary learning. Yeah. And Glenn, you have at least a child that...
I have two, actually, a senior and a junior. So my son and my wife teaches English there.
So why, I mean, you are already interested in expeditionary learning. Each of you had a slightly different but still important link to this process. Why was this something that was so necessary to each of you as individuals?
Well, I'll start by saying that. So I came out of an organization called the Coalition of Essential Schools, which was this was founded by this guy, Ted Sizer, came out of the original Annenberg Institute for School Reform, which was a 25 now, or maybe even 30 years ago, attempt to sort of reinvent American schools. Expeditionary Learning is a large, you know, national nonprofit that has roles in over 200 schools around the country. So they are, while there's sort of a small L expeditionary learning, it is also very much a model of working with schools over time. So they hired me to work for them to help get this school started and to work with other schools around Maine. And I think what I would say is the approaches that I'm very versed in that come through a couple movements are small schools, personalized schools, project-based learning. And expeditionary learning is one of the many places that can land. What they have is an extraordinarily strong and well-defined set of models so that when they can go into work with a school, they can really say, this is what we're going to do. The it is pretty well-defined. I think King Middle School is an extraordinary example in Portland. That's been a 15-year journey. But what they're able to do with a 600, you know, Casco Bay, as proud as I am of that, I helped get that running, and it is a wonderful story. But starting from scratch is easier to build those kinds of results than starting with a school in the middle. And that's one of the reasons why I do startups, is because I think you can get where you're going. You're more likely to get where you're going. Taking an existing public school and transforming it around these kinds of notions, which is what's happened at King Middle School over time, that really is an extraordinary story and a very rare one. You know, Glenn, having worked in the administration, knows that the turnaround process, which, for instance, the Gates administration, the Gates Foundation, invested a bunch of money in, turning around schools turns out to be extraordinarily difficult. The very few successes are exceptions to a very, very long. So that's I'm committed to those things because I think they work for kids. I think that they if you look at a challenge, a group of students whose needs are not being met, the kinds of educational practices that cause relationships to be necessary as opposed to be optional, which is what small schools can do, that's the way to go.
And so, Glenn, I'm really interested in the fact that both of your kids, I mean, it is one thing to make this a life work and to have a passion about it professionally, but it's just a very an interesting comment that you would send both of your kids there.
Well, you know, with Leslie teaching there, it certainly it also made it attractive on that level. But, you know, similar to John's story, when I was in graduate school, Ted Sizer, who started the Coalition of Essential Schools, was just coming to the graduate school as our dean, and he inspired so many of us to think about expedition, what would ultimately be tied in with expeditionary learning. So, to me, philosophically, we had that sort of blessing of or predisposition, anyway, towards this model. We understood as educators, my wife and I both being, you know, having taught in a high school, we understood why that model could bring out more in kids than what we saw in a traditional classroom. So we were excited about that model. And having gone to King Middle School as well, it was a natural progression. Although, in theory, at the dining room table, we'd say that the kids had choice. They could have gone to Portland or Deering. So so it is possible that they had some voice in it. But I think our strong position was that this was a good model. And in terms of Maine Academy for Natural Sciences, we, you know, just getting this federal grant allowed us to basically start having real conversations with the EL, the Expedition of Learning, you know, national conversation, and about getting consultants over there the next 2 or 3 years to help us really rebuild or build our curriculum. So as John points out, yeah, we were starting from scratch. I think our attraction, you know, going back to your early question, our attraction to charter schools models is that just where we had come from, we were really formed right after the Civil War, so we've been around a long time, and we had kind of a choice economically where we could go towards a private school model, but the private school model ends up moving towards higher socioeconomic status, and that's, you know, that's a model, actually, believe it or not, that Goodwill Hinckley had done during the 50s and 60s, when their old mission of sort of being a unique orphanage, so to speak, farm orphanage, sort of, you know, died out. When that worked for a while, and financially it worked, but the board of directors got a lot of pushback from alumni saying, you know, that's not why we were created. So one of the things that we faced in 2010 was, well, so what are we going to do if we move back to that model? A lot of the alumni won't like it. It is not really what we're set up to do. We don't want to be going after high socioeconomic students. That's not really our purpose. Is there a model out there that can make this work? And so rather than being a private school, we saw that this window of opportunity at the state level had emerged as a charter school. And to some extent, it was very philosophical. We believed in it. We wanted to be able to offer and focus on kids who were struggling. And at the same time, there were some pragmatics to this. This allowed us a sustainable revenue source that we otherwise wouldn't have for low-income kids or lower-income kids. Not that by any means are all our kids low-income. So it fit with both our philosophy and our pragmatic financial metrics that we had to meet in order to survive.
What I like about the fact that I'm able to sit with both of you right now is that you each are representing charter schools, but you're each representing a very unique school, a school that is linked to the community in which it's actually located. The Harpswell Coastal Academy has a slightly different way of approaching education based on where it is. The Maine Academy of Natural Sciences has its own unique approach. How are some of the attributes of the community, how are they working their way into your curricula?
I mean, from our point of view, obviously, agriculture is a key component of what we do. We have 2,300 acres that we're surrounded by. We have a community college that just came to our campus, and we're going to move the main campus of KVCC, Kennebec Valley Community College, to us. And they have the first ag tech program in the state. So we have a natural sequence in which our students can evolve to. But we've had a long history. You know, Reverend Hinckley, who started in the 1880s with the farm, believed that the farm had its own redemptive values, and that you could learn about nature, about human nature, about biology, about botany and horticulture, and of course agriculture, and about livestock. So that in itself was rich in learning and meaning for kids, but also in terms of learning how to be disciplined, take care of things, to be a steward of nature, and all of those things seem to fit in with a recent generation of interest in the Skowhegan Food Hub, which is looking at local, organic, sustainable food systems and trying to find ways in which they can get that market up and going. So we feel like we've stepped into the middle of something that seems to be certainly a regional trend, if not a national trend, to look at our food systems and think about, you know, how do we feed ourselves? What is it that we actually are putting in our mouths? And that trend seems to be something that we could build on from an academic point of view.
There's some interesting overlap. I noticed you're having Eleanor Kinney on later today, and she was on the steering committee of Slow Money Maine, which she's a sort of a very active member of that group, and that is a group that's also involved in the Skowhegan Food Hub, so there's some overlap there. And I think the food systems focus is one that we share. Our orientation is around natural resources, sustainable entrepreneurship, and the creative economy. So if we're really trying to look at what is it that is likely to keep young people who want to stay in Maine. And so we have the working waterfront in Harpswell, and what are the kinds of things we can do to help kids who've traditionally worked on the water, whose families have made their living from Maine's coast for years. That's a big focus for us. The food economy, which is really changing and growing. So for instance, we have a schoolhouse cafe, which is something we've started as a low-profit, limited liability company. It's a shared endeavor of Harpswell Coastal Academy and a local food group of people who want to do some of the kind of food hub work that Glenn's talking about. And our food is being prepared every day by this cafe, but with a contract with HCA, and we're feeding our kids largely locally. And they're also involved in the preparation of that food. So there's a sort of a working, Ted Sizer, one of his 10 common principles of the Coalition of Essential Schools was student as worker. And we're so maybe an emphasis that we're having at HCA is, you know, our students clean the school. Our students are part of lunch crews and work crews. We have a sustainability coordinator who's a student, and they're building a pretty robust composting system. So it's not just those are all sort of on the sustainable kind of green side of things. But if you look at artists who are entrepreneurs. One of the things that's true in Maine is that a lot of people have two or three jobs. And we're trying to turn that into an asset as opposed to, you know, if that's the way it's going to be, maybe it's not a bad idea that kids come out of high school thinking I could do this or that, or maybe I could do both of those things if I really love them, especially if we're moving away from an economy where you get a job at 18 or 20 or 24 and you keep that job for 30 or 40 years. Those BIW type jobs, the large employers that might employ kids in Maine over a long time, we don't think that that's that there's going to be enough of them to support as many kids as want to stay in Maine. The notion of low residence, what the entrepreneurs that can live anywhere, we want to build a system where if you want to do your own work from your home, you can do so and see that as a viable way to work into the future.
People who are interested in learning more about the Maine Academy of Natural Sciences, which is located at the Goodwill Hinckley campus, and also the Harpswell Coastal Academy, they can read Susan Conley's article on charter schools in Maine Magazine. How else can they find out about your schools?
They can certainly go on our website. If they go under Maine Academy for Natural Sciences, we have a website there. Also encourage them, if they're looking at visiting the school, to call Lisa Sandy. That's 238-4000, 238-4000, and just set up a time to come visit.
Yep, for us that would be Carrie Branson as our Assistant Head of School and Director of Operations, 833-3229. And we really do want people to come and see us. And matter of fact, if you not only want to learn about the school, but have something you'd want to share with our students, call us up and we can give you an audience pretty easily. Our school is set up to facilitate having people come in or having our kids get out.
And John, do you also have a website for the Harpswell Coastal
Academy?
Yeah,
and it is the very long harpswellcoastalacademy.org.
Well, it's been a privilege to sit with the two of you today. We've been speaking with Dr. Glenn Cummings, the President and Executive Director of the Maine Academy of Natural Sciences, and also with John Denary, the head of school at the Harpswell Coastal Academy. The fact that I was so fortunate to have you both in the same room at the same time and have the same conversation is wonderful, and thank you so much for taking the time to be here today.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.